Okay, thank you very much, and it's great to be back here at KITP. So what I'll be talking about today is some work I've been doing over the last few months. So most of what I will, so is that a pointer? So will be most, but most of what I'll be talking about is in this paper that with Matthias Gaberdiel, and I'll also talk about some things in a paper that's to appear soon with which is also with Tom Hartmann, who is at the Institute for Advanced Study, and Subrat Raju, who is a postdoc with us at HRI. So the basic plan is as follows. So what I will be basically aiming to convey is that there's an interesting duality between a large class of non-supersymmetric two-dimensional conformal field theories in terms of a gravity theory in ADS, ADS-3 in this case. And so what I will do initially is to just state the duality so that you have the bottom line at the beginning, and then try to explain it in more detail as I go along. So the two-dimensional CFDs will be a class of coset theories, coset WZW theories, and the theories that will be dual to them are these so-called higher spin theories. So I'll describe these in some detail, and then try to convince you why this duality holds by giving you a sort of a very detailed matching of the partition functions of both theories, as well as the RG flow pattern. I'll also, maybe if I have time, try to explain why you can hope to even maybe derive this from first principles realize holography in a very simple way. So that's the basic plan. So let me motivate it a little bit. Very often, especially when you talk to a non-string audience, you hear this thing that, okay, yeah, you have this wonderful ADS CFD and works in all these, all your examples are very nice and beautiful, but it's mostly in these supersymmetric theories. But most people are interested in sort of regular quantum field theories. And if you're a skeptic, you might even ask, how do you know this holography is not something special to supersymmetric string theories? And to what extent do you need to have an embedding in a complete string theory so for this kind of duality to hold? So it's definitely very good to try to look for larger classes of examples which have nothing to do with sort of string, which don't, at least apparently, don't arise from some standard string duality, but which you can in some first principle way try to connect the CFD and the ADS pictures. So in particular, what we'll focus on are two-dimensional conformal field theories, and in some ways these are the archetypes of non-trivial QFTs that we understand best. So what we will be asking is whether one can study a large N family of such theories and find a gravitational dual in the same sense as we are used to seeing in more conventional supersymmetric CFDs. And what I will claim is that the answer is yes for a class of these coset models, which actually for small n contain the Virasoro minimal models, which probably all of you are familiar with. But we will be looking at it in the large n limit, but it's in some ways like, if you wish, a large n limit of Ising models. And what we will exploit is not supersymmetry, which has of course been very helpful, but here we'll exploit a different symmetry, which I guess we are only beginning to understand a little better, and this is this so-called higher spin symmetry, originally introduced by Fratkin and Vasiliev and developed by Vasiliev. The conjecture that I'll be describing here is in many ways a two-dimensional, a 2D, 3D analog of the 3D, 4D conjecture by Klebanov and Polyakov for the ON vector model. one of the additional features here will be that there will be a sort of an additional Toft coupling, whereas in the ON vector model you have sort of the free fixed point and the non-trivial fixed point, but there's no sort of additional tunable parameter, whereas here we will have a Toft coupling. So that's the motivation. So let me state what the duality will be. So on the CFT side, as I've said, it's a Wessel-Minowitten theory. Specifically, it will be a SUN level k times SUN level 1 mod SUN level k plus 1 theory. For those of you who are not familiar with coset theories, I'll just have a sort of a crash course shortly. And we'll take a Toft limit of this, a large n limit, in which we keep n over k, or actually it'll be more convenient to keep this combination n over n plus k fixed. And this will give rise to a family of theories whose central charge, the two-dimensional central charge, is n into 1 minus lambda square. So you see the central charge goes like n rather than n square. So it's a vector-like model. And this is the CFT we will be considering. And the claim is that the bulk description will be a Vasiliev-type higher spin theory with spins to infinity in ADS3, together with two complex scalar fields, with the masses of those scalar fields being related to this, if you can parameterize the mass in this way, and this lambda is identified with the lambda of the CFT. And these two scalar fields will have, for reasons that I'll mention later, they'll be quantized in the two opposite ways in which you can quantize scalar fields, which lie in this window between minus 1 and 0, which is the window in ADS3 when you can quantize scalar fields in two inequivalent ways. This parameter lambda, which enters into the mass of the scalars, actually also enters into the higher spin algebra as some kind of a deformation parameter, which governs, for instance, the structure of the cubic vertices in this higher spin theory. So there are two parameters, n and k, or n and lambda in the CFT. So lambda enters into the masses as well as into the interaction vertices, if you wish, of the higher spin theory. And n plays the role that you might expect, namely the Newton's constant of the bulk theory is proportional to 1 over n. It's not 1 over n squared because the central charge is n. So it's that's the bare bones statement. And I'll the rest of the talk will be trying to explain this a little bit and to give evidence for this. So okay, any questions? Okay, so let me describe for the ADS CFT generation, at least, what coset theories are. A coset model is a sort of a two-dimensional coset model of the G mod H kind, is one in which you have a G Wessel-Minowitten theory based on group G, in which you gauge a subgroup H, but without any kinetic term for the gauge field. And the stress tensor of this G mod H theory is essentially the difference between the stress tensors of the G theory and that of the H theory. So Wessel-Minowitten CFT, you know, has this canonical Sugawara stress tensor. So you just take the differences between the tensors, and you can verify that this stress tensor has a central charge, which is just the difference of the central charges of the two theories, the theory with G and that with H. In some ways, this construction of these coset models was believed, and I don't know to what extent it was fleshed out, but it's believed to be some kind of a building block for all rational conformal field theories in two dimensions. And rational conformal field theories are, in some sense, dense in the family of two-dimensional CFTs. So these are sort of the building blocks of two-dimensional CFTs. And one of the basic cases that was that people have studied is that where you take the G to be a product of SUNs with different levels, if you want, K and L, and then H to be a diagonal subgroup of G, the diagonal SUN at level K plus L. And the case we will be focusing on is the case where L equals to 1, but we'll let K be arbitrary and in fact scale K like N. You could in principle imagine taking other values of L, at least for a small L. That's more like adding flavor to the basic story that I'll be describing. So, but the potentially interesting things you can do when you scale L with in the same way as N and K, I think it's more like a Veneziano-like limit in some sense. But I will not be talking about that. So these theories with L equal to 1 are the so-called WN minimal model series, because they possess sort of a WN symmetry, which I will describe a little later. So some basic facts about this theories. So as I said, yeah, this is the model that we will be, or the class of models that we will be focusing on. And if you use the recipe that I just mentioned in the previous page, about the central charges are given by the central charges of this Vesemann-Overton theory minus that of this one. And if you work it out, you get something like this. It's a discrete family of theories, which you can label by, I mean, it's more convenient to label it by P, which is this combination K plus N. And P takes values N plus 1, N plus 2 onwards. So this this whole, so the central charge you can see is always less than or equal to N minus 1. But you have an infinite family for every N. Where P takes values n plus 1 to n plus 2. In the case of n equal to 2, this whole construction is in fact the famous GKO construction of the unitary Virasoro discrete series. And so if you just put n equal to 2 over here, you get this famous sequence of central charges with P equal to 3, 4, and so on. P equal to 3 being the Ising model and various other statistical models for different values of P. So the other special cases which may be familiar to people, if you take for a general N, if you put K equal to 1, take the smallest member of the series, that's P equal to N plus 1, then this is what's called a Zn parafermion theory. And it describes the Zn version of the Ising model at criticality, and it has central charge something like this. If you, on the other hand, take k equal to infinity for any n, and that's taking p to infinity, and so the central charge goes like n minus 1. This limit is a little bit delicate, but and maybe I'll say something about that later. But in any case, if you there is a definite sense in which you can there's a particular way you can take this limit in which you can view this as a theory of n minus 1 free bosons. So in particular, the n equal to 2 case, this sort of this series accumulates to the theory of a single free boson at c equal to 1. But this is more general in the case of the SUN theories. So because these theories are constructed via this Cosette construction, you can say many things very explicitly about them. You can describe the spectrum of primaries very explicitly. They are labeled by two representations of SUN level k and SUN level k plus 1, respectively, which I'll denote by lambda plus and lambda minus. So lambda plus is just a label for an SUN representation, and of course, because you're looking at the Vesemann-Overton theory, it's one of the allowable or integrable representations of SUN level k. And the spectrum of dimensions is given by a very nice formula, which I've written out explicitly over here. So basically, if you write lambda plus and lambda minus in terms of your favorite way of representing representations, let's say in some Dynkin basis or orthogonal basis, then what you have to essentially compute is the norm of this vector. So rho is the so-called Weyl vector, sum of all the positive roots. And then you just consider the norm of this vector minus rho square and divided by p into p plus 1. Again, for those of you who are familiar with Bessel minimal models, for the case n equal to 2, this formula just reduces to the sort of Feigenfuchs expression for the discrete series, for all the primaries, the finite number of primaries that are present for each of these minimal models. So in general, of course, because the lambda plus and lambda minus range over some finite value, the finite number of representations, there are only a finite number of these primaries for any finite n and k. I've written out over here some of the explicit expressions for the simplest such cases. So of course, the simplest is where you take lambda plus to be the trivial representation and lambda minus to be the trivial representation, in which case this becomes zero. That's what you expect. That's the vacuum. Primary of the CFT. But the non-trivial primaries, the first non-trivial primaries, are where you take one of them to be, say, the fundamental representation. And you could take either lambda plus to be the fundamental or lambda minus to be the fundamental. And you get some rational expressions, never mind the explicit forms, just to show you that they take some nice rational, well, not so nice rational values. And you could look at, say, the adjoint representation, where lambda plus is the adjoint or lambda minus is the adjoint, and you get similarly some rational expressions. So in general, these will always give you some rational numbers, as any rational CFT is supposed to. The partition function of this theory also can be written down. It's a sum of contributions from each of these primaries. So you have these primaries and you have a Virasoro tower above them. Of course, the tricky thing is that there can be null states, and so you have to account for that. But this can be explicitly done, and the final answer is sort of written in terms of so-called branching functions, which you obtain by decomposing the characters of the Vesuminow-Witten theory based on the gauge group G in terms of those based on H. But I just want to write out the final answer for you. So basically, the partition function is a sum over the contributions from each of these primaries, so labeled by lambda plus and lambda minus, and the contribution from each primary is given by this branching function, for which there's an explicit expression. Again, just for you to know that there's an explicit expression which is given by some eta function and a sum over the affine Weyl group, which has affine translations and Weyl reflections. So there's a complicated expression, and you can see that there are null vectors all over the place. That's why this piece essentially captures that. You have terms with alternating signs. This is the sign of the Weyl reflection. So this is the analog of the usual characters for Virasoro minimal models. For the n equal to 2 case, this reduces to the usual Virasoro characters. What we will consider is the diagonal. So this is, of course, just for one chiral half of the CFT. So this is the piece which is essentially the trace Q to the L0. But you have to put the left and right pieces together. There are actually many ways you can form a modular invariant partition function from the left and right pieces. But we will focus on the simplest one, namely just consider the so-called diagonal modular invariant piece, where you just take the left and the right for each lambda plus and lambda minus, mod square and sum over all lambda plus and lambda minus. So that's the simplest model invariant partition function you can write down for these theories. The last fact, last set of facts about this theory that I want to mention is that there's a nice pattern of RG flows between these theories. You can flow between any of these minimal models for different values of k or effect or equivalently p. For fixed n, you can start with the pth minimal model and you turn on a particular relevant operator and the theory flows to the p minus 1th minimal model. Again, those of you who are familiar with Versorov minimal models, this is something you will recall. But more generally, the story is that the relevant operator of the pth minimal model is the one which is labeled by lambda plus being trivial and lambda minus being the adjoint. If you go back, you see that the h of this primary is less than 1. It's 1 minus n over n plus k plus 1. So it's a relevant operator. H and h bar are both less than 1. So it's a relevant operator which induces which if you turn on in the ultraviolet induces an RG flow, and the infrared fixed point is the p minus 1th minimal model, which has a lower central charge. And it's also known that in this process, this relevant operator becomes an irrelevant operator, and you can see that the one in which the roles of lambda plus and lambda minus are switched, namely where it's adjoint with trivial representation, is a relevant operator. It's 1 plus something positive. So this relevant operator flows to an irrelevant operator in the infrared. So in the case of the Virasoro minimal models, this is the statement that the 1 comma 3 operator flows to the 3 comma 1 operator. And similarly, the 0, the trivial with the fundamental flows to the fundamental with 0 and 0 with f bar. The anti-fundamental also similarly flows under this RG flow. So these are a collection of facts about these coset models that I wanted to review. So any questions about that? Okay, so this was a bit of a crash course. So what I will do next is to consider the Thoft limit of these minimal models. So that's what you might naively expect to do. You take n large, and this k, which is, or 1 over k is like the coupling, you take that large as well, keeping this, which is the analog of g angle square n, you keep this fixed, this ratio lambda fixed. And in this limit, many nice things happen. I mean, for some reason, this limit doesn't seem to have been looked at earlier for reasons I don't know. There's some subtle aspects to this limit, but anyway, let's see what happens when you take this limit. So essentially, you're keeping n over p fixed, because that's n over k plus n. That's what we call lambda. So you can directly see from here that this factor within brackets becomes 1 minus lambda square, and n minus 1 is approximately n in the large n limit. So you get a family whose central charge, so you get now a family of theories labeled by a continuous parameter lambda. So lambda goes between 0 and 1. Recall that k is positive. So lambda goes between 0 and 1. And you have effectively the discrete family of theories, effectively in this large n limit, becomes a continuous family labeled by this one continuous parameter lambda for any fixed n. So its central charge is scales like n. So that's good. So you have sort of vector-like theories. Since the central charge goes like n. Let's look at the dimensions of some of these operators. So we know the whole spectrum of primaries. We can look at all of the dimensions in this limit. So if you look at these simplest cases, it's easy to see that in the large n limit, this prefactor becomes half in both cases. And this just becomes 1 minus lambda. This becomes 1 plus lambda. And this operator, this again becomes just 1 minus lambda. And this is 1 plus lambda. So you see already some nice things happen. I mean, here you had a set of rational values which weren't particularly related with each other. In particular, this one and this one. It's not that they added. So in the large n limit, what in the Stoff limit, as I said, the operators. So this operator has the scaling dimension, 1 minus lambda. This is 1 plus lambda. And you see the sum of these two adds up to 1. And moreover, that of the adjoint is exactly twice that of the fundamental, and similarly over here. So the dimensions of operators there's more structure in, you see more structure into the dimensions. In fact, they'll arrange themselves into a Fock space, which is what you expect in the large n limit, that that you have. These will be sort of like multi-trace operators built out of these single-trace operators. So a very crude way, I mean.
Is there a dimension, the number of boxes plus anti-boxes?
Roughly, I'll say a little bit about that later, yeah. But it's related exactly to that that kind of thing. So, but there's a lambda dependence as well. So, so in general, representations which are finite tensor products of fundamentals and anti-fundamentals will have finite dimensions. There are lots of operators. I mean, this general formula for the spectrum, you can look at it and ask when is this finite in the large n limit. There are you'll obviously find many operators whose dimensions will go like n, will go like n square, and so on. But the ones that are finite in the large n limit will be ones which are built out of finite number of finite tensor products of fundamentals and anti-fundamentals. There's a very interesting degeneration phenomenon which happens in this limit, which maybe I will. I'm not sure I want to go into that in detail. Maybe for people who are interested, I can say later. But something that will be important for us later is that. Just consider the Virasoro minimal models when you take p to infinity. So this is of course not in the Toff limit because you're keeping n equal to 2 and taking p or k to infinity. But something similar happens in this case. So I just want to point out one fact. So if you look at this familiar expression for the dimensions of operators in the Virasoro minimal models as p goes to infinity. The dimensions go like r minus s the whole square by 4. So the dimensions only depend on the difference between r and s. R and s are the two integers which label the representations, essentially. In this particular case, for n equal to 2, you have SU2, so you have only one integer to label the representations. And that's what we're calling r and s. So things depend only on the difference. And so there's a large number of primaries which become degenerate with the vacuum. In particular, at any level, there's a large degeneracy. And the Virasoro characters also become reducible. Something similar happens in the Toff limit. There's, again, if you consider representations R and R, their dimension goes like 1 over n, and the characters become reducible. This will be important for later when we actually match the characters with that of the bulk. And the limit is actually even more subtle than the Virasoro case, but I think it's a subtlety we understand from the CFT point of view. But from the bulk point of view, I think it's something interesting. Probably it probably is a reflection of some exotic black hole-like states in the bulk. But I can talk. I'll talk about that later. So let me say a little bit about the symmetries of this theory. So these theories, these coset models, were originally introduced because they have an extended symmetry, a so-called WN symmetry, beyond the Virasoro symmetry. So in addition to the spin 2 stress tensor, they have higher spin conserve currents of spin 3 all the way up to n. So for a SUN coset theory, you have conserved currents all the way up to n, and a very nice way to understand what they are is described in Joe's book. In fact, that was the easiest place for me to understand how to construct these. So for instance, for the spin 3 current, what you do is just consider, you basically construct these currents from a higher order Casimir invariance. And you take the currents, so J1 and J2 are the currents of the numerator pieces, SUN level K and SUN level 1, and you construct various cubic combinations of J1 and J2, and you demand that they have a non-singular OPE with the diagonal, namely J1 plus J2, and that fixes these coefficients A1, A2, A3, and A4 uniquely, and you can convince yourself that there are always enough freedom in these coefficients to always be able to construct one operator of spin 3, in fact, one operator of any of these spins, which has a non-singular OPE with the diagonal that you're gauging, namely J1 plus J2. So you construct these from the, so SUN theory has Casimirs, higher order Casimirs up to order n, so you can construct using them, you can construct these higher spin currents up to spin n, and the OPE amongst these is much more non-trivial compared to that of the Virasoro algebra. They obey, in fact, a nonlinear symmetry algebra, namely quadratic pieces appear on the right-hand side of the OPE or the commutator. So it's not a Lie algebra, but it's a nonlinear symmetry algebra. And in fact, there are very few explicit results about these for finite n beyond, I think, spin 3 or spin 4, but it's clear that they exist. So that was about the CFT, and we'll use these higher spin symmetries as a bridge now to the.
But this, in the end, goes to infinity.
You have spin. Yeah, well, it's a little bit tricky actually. So in the limit as n goes to infinity, there, it turns out that there's a one-parameter family of W infinity algebras, which actually will be labeled by a parameter lambda, which can be identified with the Stoff parameter, and only the case where lambda equal to zero corresponds to the area preserving diffeomorphism symmetry. So that's in fact the case of sort of n-free fermions in some sense. So actually, that's what is sometimes called the W1 plus infinity. But So the n goes to infinity limit, it's related to these area-preserving diffeomorphism symmetries, but they can be also deformed. Now to switch so this was about the CFT, and we took its Stoff limit, saw certain simplifications, it has these big symmetries. So what does all this have to do with the ADS, an ADS-like description. Okay, so let me tell you some facts about higher spin symmetries in ADS. So maybe all of you have heard this by now, that unlike flat space, in anti-de Sitter space, you can have consistent classical theories of higher spin gauge fields. But typically in any ADS, like ADS4 or ADS5, you need an infinite tower of these fields. You need massless higher spin fields of spins 2, 3, 4, all the way to infinity, or maybe the even ones in some cases. But you need an infinite tower of them. And the classical action is very complicated, essentially understood only by Vasiliev and maybe a few of his collaborators. But there is a well-defined action, and but it has infinite number of derivatives. It's actually expressed in terms of infinite number of auxiliary fields as well, which is what makes it very complicated. But it's so you can imagine. I mean, the complexity comes from the fact that you have these gauge fields, and so each of these spin 2 fields, spin 3 fields, each of them have their own gauge symmetry. So the gauge fields are sort of rank S tensors, which have some kind of linearized gauge symmetry of this kind. And you want to write down an action which is invariant simultaneously under all these gauge transformations. Even at the quadratic level, it's not very obvious, though it's not too difficult to write down the quadratic action for these fields invariant under this gauge transformation. But at the nonlinear interacting level, it's very complicated in general, and that's what Vasiliev spent 20 years developing. And by now, for ADS4 and ADS5, there exist complete descriptions, I believe, for the classical action of these theories. But in ADS3, things are much simpler. So anyone who is interested in trying to understand these higher spin symmetries, I would suggest they start with ADS3, because many things about the ADS3 case is simpler, and I think it captures some of the features of the general theory as well. So the first thing about ADS3 is that in this case, you actually can truncate to a finite number of these fields. Namely, you can truncate to a theory in which you have spins 2, 3, all the way up to some finite number n. So all the fields. So if you can have either spin 2 and spin 3, or spin 2, 3, and 4, all the way up to for any n, you can construct a theory. And in fact, the gauge fields, the classical action for the gauge fields, can be written down in a fairly nice way, in a fairly familiar way. It can be written in terms of an SLNR times SLNR Chern-Simons theory. So a regular Chern-Simons theory with a cubic interaction term in which the gauge group is SLNR times SLNR. This is in the case n equal to 2, where you have only spin 2, this is in fact the SL2R times SL2R description of ADS3 gravity.
So the entire theory is just the Chern-Simons theory with this group? So you don't have fundamental fields of higher spin. You just have the gauge field.
You have this gauge field, but the gauge field encodes in a way the higher spin fields in a way which I'll just sketch in a moment. So firstly, this is for the pure Vasiliev theory with spins 2 up to n. In our case, we will actually also have scalars, which will complicate things a bit. But the higher spin sector of the theory is described purely by a Chern-Simons.
N equals 2.
That's the SL2R times. So this was.
Okay.
So this is the Townsend, Achukaro Townsend, Witten description of gravity, classical gravity in ADS3. But more generally, it's an SLNR times SLNR theory. And because it's a Chern-Simons-like theory, there are no propagating degrees of freedom. And you can do a count of the degrees of freedom, and you can show that even these higher spin fields in ADS3 don't have propagating degrees of freedom. So how is this? So the canonical form, I mean the traditional formulation of the higher spin fields would have been in terms of rank S tensor, symmetric tensor. But to go to this Chern-Simons-like description, you go to a sort of a generalized field bind connection kind of description in which you have a field bind which is which now carries sort of S minus one additional indices and a connection which also so normally the connection would have had omega mu nu, but because you're in three dimensions, you can take the dual and get something with just one Lorentz index. But now you have additional sort of S minus one generalized tangent space indices. So just to maybe give you a sense for how it works, basically this field pi mu 1 to mu s, you write it in terms of something like E mu 1 and well, these are the regular field binds. So you essentially, or you can write it the other way around. Basically, you convert S minus one of these into tangent space indices. So you can write things in terms of these generalized field binds and connections, and then you form SLNR gauge fields from these. So actually, once you have these E mu A1 to AS minus 1, you can assemble them all into generators of SLNR. I can explain that to you more detail later, but you can actually even count and see that you get n square, you have n square degrees of freedom. So basically, you put together all the fields up from spin 2 all the way up to n into one big SLNR matrix. So you combine all of them. And that's what you would imagine, because this higher spin symmetry, essentially, the higher spin gauge symmetry mixes up all the spin 2 fields, the spin 3 fields. So you really need to put them all together into one gauge field. This formulation, by the way, was originally due to Blenko and then also developed by Kelly Stell and Bergshoff and Blenko. So you form these gauge fields. So you basically take, just like in the SL2R case, you take E plus minus omega and form two sets of gauge fields, A and A tilde, and the action is just the difference of the Chern-Simons actions with a level which is related to the radius of ADS and the Newton's constant in the usual way. So recently what Heno and Ray and also the group in Potsdam showed was they did a Brown-Heno type analysis of the asymptotic symmetries of this theory. So, and showed that you can generalize the Brown, I mean, in the Brown-Heno analysis, which you can also do in the Chern-Simons framework, you show that there's an asymptotic Virasoro algebra. What you find here is that there is the asymptotic symmetry algebra is a WN algebra. So this is the same WN that I was describing earlier. And the central charge is the same as the Brown-Henro central charge. It's
the nonlinearity of the algebra, how does that arise from the bulk? Is that a complication? In fact, the WN is not a linear algebra.
How does that arise from?
Is that sort of nonlinear in N?
Yes.
It means you have 1 over N terms, I think, in the algebra, because you have bilinears.
You have bilinears, that's right. So, but they would be, but you're asking how do you see that classically in the classical?
Do they see that in their?
Yeah, they do see the nonlinear terms. In fact, they worked it out explicitly for W3, and there itself you see the nonlinear terms. And so I think, they are probably suppressed by, one over L, but I think they're definitely there in the symmetry algebra. In fact, that's how they conclude that it's a WN. But actually there's a classical limit of the WN algebra, which in which the nonlinear terms get I think there's a classical limit of the WN algebra in which the pieces which say, so I think you have something like WWOPE will have, I don't know, maybe TT terms. And there are pieces over here which are, there's some number. And then there are pieces proportional to the central charge which are quantum corrections. What I think they see are the leading pieces. So they don't see this number, they see only the central charge, whatever. So this is sort of, this is like N or 1 over G Newton, but then there's an additional correction which you would see only at the quantum level, which they don't see. So this was the higher spin theory. So this was a classical analysis, a Brown-Henno-type analysis. But you can actually do a one-loop calculation of the quadratic fluctuations of these gauge fields. So you have the quadratic terms. It doesn't really matter whether you use the Chern-Simons theory or the original formulation. They're both, because at the quadratic level, as I mentioned earlier, you can write down the action respecting these gauge invariances in a fairly straightforward way. In fact, it was done by Franz Dahl even before, much before any of this Vasiliev-like description. What you get when you do a one-loop calculation is you have to gauge fix, and then you get some determinants for a spin S field. And I want to tell you what the final answer is for a spin S field. If you just compute all the determinants, so this is now for the one loop determinants in ADS with some boundary torus. So it's thermal ADS in which there's a boundary torus whose parameter is Q, a modular parameter is Q. So this is the contribution for a given spin S field. If you put together the contributions, well, you can do it for any finite n, but if you do it for all the spins, you get a nice function which has appeared in many other contexts called the MacMahon function, which is essentially it's a sort of interesting generalization of the eta function. It has 1 minus q to the n to the n. But the nice thing about this, the reason I'm showing you this, is that this is the so-called vacuum character of W infinity, namely, just like the vacuum character of the Virasoro algebra is the character that you get from all the states acted upon by the vacuum by L minus 2 and all other descendants. There's a similar vacuum character of W infinity that you can write down, and that's precisely this. So at this stage, this is meant to just tell you that you can realize this WN symmetry. So quantum mechanically, the Vasiliev spectrum knows about the WN symmetry or the W infinity symmetry in the bulk. The W infinity symmetry of the boundary theory. So this was purely the higher spin part of the ADS theory that I described. So if you remember in the beginning when I described the duality, I mentioned that we have higher spin fields and additional scalars and fermions. So again, it's a property of ADS3 that in addition to the higher spin multiplet, you can have a separate multiplet involving just scalars and fermions. This is not true in higher dimensions where the scalar is part of the higher spin multiplet, but in the case of ADS3, you can have two independent multiplets under the symmetry. One is this higher spin multiplet that spins all the way up to n, and then the other is just a simple multiplet involving scalars, and if you want, you can have scalars and fermions. That's sort of the supersymmetric case. But I'll consider the case where you just have scalars. And so the masses of these scalars is now a free parameter in this Vasiliev theory. So this ADS3 Vasiliev theory has one extra free parameter, which sets the scale of the masses. So you can parameterize it in this way. But this parameter also affects then the structure of interactions, cubic vertices, and so on. The particular dual, which will be relevant to us, is one in which you have two complex scalars and with equal masses. And the reason we'll have two complex scalars is because will be clear shortly. We not only have these two complex scalars, we want to quantize each of them in opposite ways. So recall that lambda was between 0 and 1, so this mass square is between minus 1 and 0. And that's the window in which you can quantize scalars in two inequivalent ways. And
is that required? I mean, is that a choice you're making here?
It's a choice I'm making here.
The theory is actually consistent with any
quantization, any of the quantization, but this is a choice.
The Bok theory is consistent? Quantization, you're saying, or you're making a statement about the
Bok? No, the bulk theory. Yeah. So, I can choose the scalars to have been, at least I'm not aware of any consistency condition which tells you that one of the scalars has to be in the plus and the other in the minus. You can have any number of scalars. So, if the Vasiliev theory, as far as I know, is consistent with any number of scalars.
Well, mass square could be positive.
Mass square could be positive, but then, so there's some discrete values at which special things happen and so on, but yeah. This is a particular. So the choice that we will make is to quantize each of these in one of the two opposite ways. So the one which corresponds to the plus quantization will correspond to a field which will have dimension. So if you take this parameterization, the dimension is half into 1 plus lambda. And the other one will have dimension half into 1 minus lambda. And you see that these were the dimensions of the two basic fields. Which we had several transparencies ago.
What is the difference of quantization?
Because there are two sets of normalizable modes when the masses are in this. And so Brighton-Lohner and Friedman, I think, showed that when we are in this window, there are two ways consistent with the ADS symmetry. Of course, you could take a linear combination of them, and that would break the ADS symmetry. You have H plus and H minus, which are given by this, and the sum of the dimensions have to add up to one because these are the two this thing, and that's precisely what we needed in the CFT. In the CFT, we saw that the dimensions were of the the dimension of the H. Fundamental with zero was this, and H zero with fundamental was that, is what we want. And they're complex because we have the fundamental as well as the anti-fundamental. We have for general SUN, we have we have sort of two primaries with this dimension. So the bulk theory, which we will consider, has this tower of massless fields together with these two complex scalars with this quantization. So that's the bulk theory. So now let me tell you some of the checks of this, the detailed checks that that work. So the zeroth order check is, of course, the matching of the symmetries, which I mentioned earlier. And in fact, there's a more general way in which you can talk about this W infinity of lambda that I mentioned. But I won't go into that now. But basically,
one question before we go to the checks.
Yeah.
Is there a unique way to couple the scalar sector to the higher spin sector?
Yes. I mean, with this parameter lambda, yes.
Yeah, so the lambda is the mass, but then the interaction
is governed. That's right. So the Vasiliev theories are unique up to this parameter lambda.
What makes it unique? Are these theories consistent if you try to do things differently?
Yeah, under the higher spin symmetry. So it's
probably violate the WN symmetry.
The higher W infinity or higher spin symmetries in this case, too. This is part of Vasiliev's work. In fact, even in ADS4, there's a one-parameter family of non-unique theories, but there you have to break parity. And so the Klebanov-Polyakov case is the case where you don't break parity, and there are people I think who are studying that case in which you have this additional parameter, and okay, I can talk about that later. We'll see how the spectra of the two theories match, at least at n equal to infinity. At n equal to infinity, these higher spin fields are what I call generalized boundary gravitons, because they don't have any propagating fields in the bulk, but they have these Brown-Hanau-like fields on the boundary. And that's the contribution that you got from the determinant. And this is the same expression that I wrote down earlier. So you have this piece of the higher spin theories give you the higher spin gravitons, pure excitations of the gravitons, give you this contribution to the partition function. And in the CFT, this is precisely what I mentioned earlier. It's the character of the vacuum representation. I'll have this probably on my next slide. Remember, these were these... I wrote down... The so-called branching functions, which give you the net contribution of the CFT, and so if you take the vacuum contribution, where both of these are the zero, the vacuum contribution you can check in this large n limit. This piece in which you set lambda plus and lambda minus both to zero. This precisely goes over to this thing over here, this MacMahon function. This higher spin pieces, and that's in a way natural, that captures the vacuum character of the CFT, the vacuum representation of the CFT. This was only the contribution from the higher spin fields. But you have these two propagating fields of dimension, which correspond to operators of dimension half into 1 plus minus lambda, which, as I said, correspond to these primaries as well as the ones with the bars on them. If you ask what they contribute in the bulk, you can do a one-loop calculation of the scalar determinants as well. So if you put them all together, you have a classical piece, which is the q to the minus c over 24, So I'm talking about the bulk calculation of the spectrum now. So in the bulk, if you do this is the classical piece of the bulk action, and then you have the one loop determinant, which has the contribution from the higher spin fields that I wrote down earlier, and then contributions from these scalars with the opposite quantization. And each of the scalar determinants is given by some infinite product like this. So so this is the object that we would like to compare with the CFT partition function, because this is the exact spectrum at n equal to infinity in the bulk. And then this is what should agree with the CFT partition function if the duality is indeed true. And as you can see, there's a lot of structure in here. So the way, the work that's to appear with Tom Hartman, Gabardiel, and Subrat Raju, so you can rewrite this in a way which matches with the CFT answer. Firstly, you can rewrite this in terms of representations of U infinity, in terms of characters of representations of U infinity. So these are sum over all Young tableaus of U infinity. And you can put together, so this is for each scalar determinant, you can write it that way. So if you put them all together, it's a sort of a complicated sum over various Young tableaus of of U infinity times this MacMahon function, this M tilde. This is what you would want to compare with the CFT partition function that I wrote here, which and when you take the n equal to infinity limit. So there are some. I'm not sure. I run out of time. But the process of taking this large n. So a limit of the CFT is a little subtle, as I said, because several irreducible representations, which are irreducible for any finite n and k, become reducible in the large n limit. And in fact, they don't just become reducible. They become, so there are, in some cases, things become reducible. So you get something here, and so in a block diagonal form. So then that's fine. The character reduces to, you get the sum of the characters and you have reducible representations. But there are other cases in which things become sort of in a Jordan canonical form. This is what is technically called an indecomposable representation in the CFT literature. And what happens in this case is that effectively one piece of one of these blocks is what contributes to correlation functions. It's a bit like null vectors. You have the additional states decoupled from all correlation functions, and you get sort of a contribution only from one of the blocks. So you have to correct for that in this particular case. So you can read all the joyous technicalities in our paper. But there are very nice simplifications that happen even to the CFT partition function, which effectively become like U infinity characters. So there's some kind of a hidden U infinity here, which we don't still understand completely. But you can see that these branching functions that I wrote down get reduced to sort of pieces of the Valinde formula. The S matrices, and then if you use the Valinde formula, they simplify even further, and you get these pieces which are like U infinity characters. In any case, when you put them all together, the CFT answer also sort of quite miraculously, I think, falls into the same form as the bulk answer. So there's this complicated CFT answer, and then there's this bulk piece which one got from the determinants of all these scalar fields and the higher spin fields, and the two agree. So that, to us, is a strong confirmation of the of this correspondence. And there's another check one can do, which is to do with these RG flows that I mentioned earlier, in which you go from states, the theories labeled by P to P minus 1. So you can check that the corresponding operators have exactly the. So in fact, the fact that things are quantized in these two opposite ways is very crucial for that, because you turn on one of them, the relevant one, and then it flows and it becomes the other one. And that's what you have in ADS, that when you turn on a double trace operator corresponding to, so you turn on the zero adjoint, which you can view as a sort of double trace operator of the basic fundamental prime. The primary built out of the fundamental, and then what you have when you turn on this double trace operator is that it takes the field in the plus quantization to the minus. So so that works very neatly. Again, you needed the dimensions to have this property. Finally, I think I'll just close very soon. So finally, I think you can probably even derive this duality. In some ways, it smells a little like the usual Chern-Simons Wesemann-Witten connection because of this SLNR Chern-Simons. But it's a little more subtle. Firstly, this is an SLNR, SLNR theory, and you're in ADS, and the boundary conditions are a little different. But the additional boundary conditions that you have for asymptotically ADS geometries, at least the boundary conditions that you impose in this Chern-Simons theory, are not the ones that you would give you the normal chiral Wesemann-Witten theories, and that's also not what you want. You don't want the Wesemann-Witten theory, you want this Cosette theory. So it does seem as if, so the kind of boundary conditions are some kind of more general boundary conditions in which you set certain components of this A and A tilde to zero. And this was studied by people in the 80s. It's what is called the Drinfeld-Sokolov reduction of the Wesemann model. At least classically, this was what is studied. And at the quantum level, people have in fact conjectured that these Cosette theories would arise from such a reduction. So I think something like that probably is what gives the connection between these higher spin theories and the Cosette theories. But this was all without the scalars, and I think the scalars play an important role. So I think that's something to be understood better. So I'll just close with the list of things I think that that one can do. And so yeah, let me just stop over here. Yeah.
So I guess I have two questions.
Yeah.
When you said that there's no bulk, no local bulk degrees of freedom, is that even including the scalars?
No. The scalars are propagating. Yeah. So in fact, I think there's something potentially interesting, and that's what you can probably have. Goodpearl and Krauss have solutions with additional W3 hair in these. So there are BTZ black holes, of course, in these theories. But you can have ones with these with W3 charges and higher spin charges. But I think there should be ones with scalar charges hair as well. And that may explain some of these funny properties of the CFT. And it looks like there should be some exotic classes of black hole solutions in these theories involving the scalars. That's not been studied.
So the second question is, you talked about these renormalization group flows.
Yeah.
Do you have bulk solutions which flow sort of in the radial direction?
When you turn on these kinds of operators, the bulk geometry remains the same. It's only the scalar profile which interpolates between the. So it's only the scalar field.
All the higher spin fields don't change.
I think so. I think only the scalar field profile changes. In the typical cases in ADS where people have turned on, these double trace operators, at least a leading order in N, I think there's no back reaction on the higher spin fields. There's certainly no back reaction on the metric. It's only the scalar field which has an interpolating kind of profile. So I think this should be true here. But I think there's something interesting there, because in the boundary theory, these are known to be integrable models. They are massive theories now, which flow between one CFD to the other. And they are integrable models in which people have even worked out the spectrum of masses exactly. So one should be able to reproduce that from the bulk. All these people in the integrability literature they are sort of deformed gross Nevo-like models, because they are terms involving psi bar psi, the whole square kind of deformations. And so you know the spectrum, and it should be possible to see that explicitly in the bulk. And that's when one would really check this, whether the scalar fields is sufficient to reproduce that.
Yeah, you described this rather complicated spectrum of operators in the CFT, and I didn't quite get whether you said you completely understood that in the bulk, or this involves some new.
Okay, so the status is as follows. So in the n equal to infinity limit, the spectrum becomes essentially discrete spectra, which are that of the lowest primary, which is H plus and H minus, two lowest primaries, and then just multiples of them, so forming a Fock space. And that's what matches with the bulk multiparticle states of these scalars. But the subtlety is the following, that if you, so actually, there's an infinite number of states which collapse to that. That's the thing that we don't completely understand. So at n equal to infinity, if you look at the spectrum of operators, there's the vacuum, and then there are a pair of them, something like this, but. The thing at any large but finite n, there's a infinite sort of a spacing of states which I have dimension 1 over n around these, and they all in the strict n equal to infinity limit, they just collapse to this. The bulk interpret, it seems as if there is and that's what you see from here, that there's a you can see that these states essentially decouple from the correlation functions at n equal to infinity, so you only pick sort of one of them when you're computing correlation functions. But at any finite but large n, they are there in the theory. And they will couple weakly. And this is what, many people with whom I've discussed this with about which there's been some discussion going on, believe that these are probably some kind of exotic black hole-like states, because if you see the density of states of these, they have a sort of they have a Cardi-like growth. So it's like there is a family of black holes whose masses come down to zero, but which is not something you normally see in
become degenerate with particle states.
Going away from n equal to infinity, I think there are some subtleties to understand here. So of course, the Vasilev theories, I think, strictly speaking, you only look at them at the classical level, but here you want to go a little bit beyond the classical level to the one leading 1 over n corrections and see what you get.
Why do you only go on the classical level?
I mean, because this John Simons theory is given to only, it's the classical description. You don't know how to quantize the John Simons theory because it's a non-compact John Simons theory. So you don't know what the, from the bulk point of view, you don't know what is the quantum Vasilev theory. Presumably, if this duality is correct, then it's the CFD, which is the quantum version of the Vasiliev theory. Yes.
You know what happens if you add Maxwell terms to the Chern-Simons construction in the bulk? Consistent with the symmetry?
No, I think you need it to be background independent. Because this Chern-Simons action is background independent. It's independent of the background metric. A Maxwell term, you need a background metric, which is, so.
It would also be unbounded from below because it's a non-compact group.
Yeah. Mm. So at an SLNR, it would not make sense.
So the Vasiliev theory was only consistent because it was on ADS.
ADS, yes, because of the curvature terms. I think you can even have it on De Sitter.
How did that become a Chern-Simons, which didn't care about background? Was it just because you
Chern-Simons? No. The Chern-Simons, I didn't describe that. The choice of the gauge group reflects the Chern-Simons. So just like Einstein gravity on ADS 3 has gauge group SL2R times SL2R, whereas that on De Sitter will have gauge group SU2 times SU2. So the SLNR times SLNR comes from the ADS. Yes.
In the studies of W gravities, in fact, you start with W infinity at the classical level. The quantization you form from W1 plus infinity.
Remind us what the difference is.
But there's a spin one field as well. Here, maybe there are theories with an additional spin one current as well. You could maybe have an. I don't see any need for it here. You could probably consider theories with W1 plus infinity symmetry, but. I think the context where I think that's where that's useful, but yeah.
Planck's constant was acting as a deformation parameter.
I see. But here I'm not gauging the. It's not W gravity. I mean, this is just a this is just a global symmetry, so I'm not gauging that symmetry in the bulk in the boundary theory. It's purely a global W. And symmetry.
So when you talk about these massive theories being integrable, does that mean that I can think of the state in those theories as being determined by some infinite list of charges, conserved charges?
Yeah.
And do you know what those charges look like in the bulk? Are they sort of obvious higher spin charges on the boundary?
I think there would be, there would be some. So you obviously wouldn't preserve this full W infinity symmetry when you turn on the masses or turn on the, but probably you preserve enough of them and which you can follow through at any finite.
State is entirely determined by a set of higher spin charges that are basically boundary integrals. Doesn't that mean there really aren't any local degrees of freedom in the theory?
Any local degrees of freedom? No. Why do you say? There are. Are you talking about the bulk or the boundary?
Well, they're dual.
Yes. So
if I can give you what's effectively boundary data at a given time, which would include, it sounds like a list of this infinite number of charges if they're all just flux integrals of higher spin gauge integrals on the boundary.
Yeah, but in a two-dimensional theory, two-dimensional quantum field theories, you have infinite number of conserved charges, and they are non-trivial well.
Now, it sounds like in the bulk, you've just given me a recipe for deducing what's going on in the interior, given a set of conserved charges on the boundary. I might have thought that was the definition of a theory with no local degrees of freedom.
I don't know. I mean, definitely the higher spin fields don't have any local degrees of freedom, but the scalar fields definitely do. So.
In two dimensions, an infinite number of conserved charges is even compatible with interaction.
Exactly. That's why these are the Gross-Nevo model and all these theories have because it doesn't violate this, you get non-trivial S matrices in two dimensions. So somehow that must be reflected in the bulk. I mean, I can't say exactly, I can't tell you right now exactly how it should be reflected in the bulk, but it should be.
Do you know what the dual of the thermal partition function of this theory is at large M?
So this contribution of this perturbative states contribute to the thermal partition function and reproduce the part of the CFT which corresponds to these primaries and their tensor products. But presumably there's also the states whose dimensions grow like n, but which have also a large entropy. But at large at finite n, there's probably a contribution also from those. And there can be a Hawking page transition. We don't still know. It would depend on these states. These states and where this Hawking page transition. So one thing one can definitely say. I mean, the partition function of the CFT is modular invariant. So we know that when you take tau to 1 over tau or minus 1 over tau. I mean, you do get there are two different saddle points in a sense in the bulk, for small temperatures you would have the saddle point corresponding thermal ADS, but then for large temperatures it would be the saddle point corresponding to BTZ. So there's definitely some phase transition that would happen at tau equal to 1 or I, but the question is whether you can have other phase transitions due to other black holes. So that, I don't know.
But so the CFT understanding of that certainly probably depends on all of these states.
So you would have to look at it at large but finite n, which is a little tricky. So our analysis used many aspects which were strictly at n equal to infinity, to do it systematically away from that, you would need to know various things. For instance, how these decouple from these states in some way that goes to zero as n goes to infinity, but whether it goes exponentially in n or if it were black holes, presumably it would go like e to the minus n. But if it were some other states, which it could in principle also go like 1 over n to some power. But to check that, one would have to do a difficult calculation in the CFT to check the three-point functions of some state in these with this. And my collaborator is a CFT expert, and he tells me that three-point functions for these theories are very difficult. So for large n and k, I mean, SU2, of course, you can do it, but for large n, they're not easy. In fact, I think that the ADS description really, in the spirit of the ADS CFT, that should be really the way how you should calculate correlation functions in the CFT at large, for large n. I think for the case of the spectrum, of course, we knew the CFT gave you the whole thing. But I think for more general quantities, correlation functions, I think gravity should be finally the simpler way. Though, of course, in this case, for every value of lambda, so it's not like there's any lambda going to infinity limit. There's only lambda between 0 and 1.
Mr. Tokin, 5 minutes, I think that's fine.